Welcome to the Feisty Women's Performance Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Gross, Ironman champion, PhD in women's history, and founder and CEO of Feisty Media. I started this show because I wanted to cut through the BS of diet culture and fitness culture and actually learn from high-achieving women at the top of their game who have figured out how to feel and perform their best at every stage of life. So I chat with experts, elite athletes, and leaders who have learned to succeed despite the massive gender data gap in exercise and medical science and product development. Every episode is filled with information, advice, and anecdotes that will help you fulfill your potential as an athlete, mom, leader, or business owner. And listen up. If you don't subscribe to our Women's Performance newsletter, you are definitely missing out. It's totally free. So head over to womensperformance.com and subscribe now. That's womensperformance.com. This podcast is a production of Feisty Media. Hello, Feisty friends. Sarah Gross here. Thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode of the Women's Performance Podcast. For the next 4 weeks, you are in for a treat. I am extremely happy to present a four-part mini-series all about how our female hormones affect our performances in sport and life. The series is called Hormonal. And I love that name because who among us has not been talked down to and disregarded with the use of that word? Oh, just ignore Sarah. She's hormonal. Or you know how women get sometimes. They are so hormonal. At Feisty, we are all about reclaiming language, turning it on its head and saying, yeah, we are hormonal and it's amazing. And we are going to harness those hormones to get the best out of our bodies. The mini-series is hosted by two women who are truly subject experts. First, double board certified obstetrician and reproductive endocrinologist Dr. Carla DiGirolamo, who has been featured in Boston Magazine as one of Boston's best doctors every year since 2019. Carla is joined by Feisty's own Celine Yeager, who has been hosting the Hit Play, Not Pause podcast since 2020 and has conducted over 160 interviews with leading experts and top athletes in the perimenopause and menopause space. Combined with her background as a health and science journalist, Celine is great at reading the research and translating it into actionable steps for active women. During these four episodes, over the next 4 weeks, you will learn everything you need to know to work with your body and perform. Episode one covers all the basics about your hormones, whether you really need to sync your training routine with your menstrual cycle, how to know when and why you might need hormone testing, and what happens when your hormones start fluctuating in your 40s or flatten out in your 50s and beyond. In episode two, Celine and Carla cover hormonal contraceptives. We all want to know about birth control, don't we? And how it affects our training. They cover pregnancy and fertility as they relate to our physical activity. And in episode three, the two discuss common hormonal problems like PCOS and endometriosis. And if all of your questions are not answered after those three episodes, you can ask. So episode four answers listener questions about hormones. I've seen some of the questions that have already come in and they are so good. If you have a question and it's before the end of April 2024, just head to the show notes, click on the link and ask away. So for everyone who is sick of the narrative that women's hormones are a curse instead of a blessing, we are here for you. And together we will learn how amazing it actually is to be hormonal.
Okay, Carla, my endocrinologist friend, I am really excited to have you in here for this four-part series on the Women's Performance Podcast on hormones, because I have been in this game a very long time, and I know you have too, and I have not ever seen, whether you're talking about cycle syncing or the luteal phase or ovulation, I've never seen so much attention being paid to hormones. Have you?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's been gaining so much traction. I know there's been two conferences, the Female Athlete Conference in Boston that you and I were both at, and there was one in Minnesota that I just spoke at. And all the topics about periods and about cycles and hormones and how they relate to female performance. I mean, it's receiving so much attention, and more research is being dedicated to it. I think it's a very, very exciting time in this area.
So let's break it down. Because there's a lot, as with anything, once it gains some traction, sometimes it goes a little off the rails and then achieves escape velocity in some direction where you're like, I don't think that was the original idea here. So let's bring it all back down and talk about how our ovarian hormones impact sports and exercise performance.
So, I mean, it goes back to the very basics of how we're wired biologically as women. And if you think about evolutionarily, it's right in front of us. And I think the key is to see that and to work with it rather than against it. So think about our fight or flight response. This is our survival response. Our ability to spring into action physically to fight off a physical threat is mediated by the neuroendocrine system. And the other area where females more uniquely have more profound physical adaptation is in carrying a pregnancy. In pregnancy, you see tremendous adaptations of the cardiovascular system and the musculoskeletal system as well. I mean, it's profound what our bodies accomplish during that time. And again, it's all mediated by the endocrine system. And so, if we can take these things that nature has programmed within us, that automatically extrapolates to physical performance, exercise, et cetera. And go with Mother Nature instead of against it. That's where the Holy Grail is, because nature gave us such a gift of physical adaptation and fitness that the best we can do is to use it in our favor, to our advantage.
So when we're looking at the hormonal response specifically, and I know that we have as females like sort of this unique interplay with the fight or flight and the HPA axis and in our hormonal system, like are there unique roles of estrogen and progesterone themselves in this system and in exercise performance?
I think that's an area of research that's emerging. Some of the research that has been done has shown that in the earlier part of our cycles, our menstrual cycles, say the follicular phase, which is about the first 14 days, we know that carbohydrate utilization is more efficient during that time. Whereas after ovulation in the luteal phase, fatty acid oxidation is more predominant. So we're seeing trends where we use our nutrients differently in different phases of the menstrual cycle. And in the early phases, the estrogen and progesterone are on the lower side, whereas the post-ovulatory phase, they're quite high. So I don't think we quite know yet exactly what the mechanisms are and exactly how these hormones directly impact performance, but I think we're learning that it does because there are certain things that affect performance that correlate with these phases of the cycle.
And can we give some examples of those?
Well, for instance, if one believes in cycle timing, because there's a lot of controversy out there about performance and timing them with your menstrual cycles, the best time to be doing your explosive, big, heavy lifts, so to speak, would be in the early phase of your cycle. Whereas in the latter parts of the cycle, that's more long endurance because, again, fatty acid oxidation is more predominant. That is what really helps us with those, long endurance types of activities. So those are some examples of what kind of training maybe we think about during those phases. But I think the area of controversy is to whether or not that actually translates into improved performance. And I think the reason why it's so hard to make that definitive link is because we're studying a system that is highly variable. Even within one individual female, her menstrual cycles are not exactly the same every month. She may have 10 ovulatory cycles in a 12-month period. That is perfectly normal. Any one time of ovulation might happen on day 12, one month, it might happen on day 16 the next, and all of that is within the normal range. So even individually, cycles are variable. Then when you extend that out to populations of women, you still have that much more exponential variability. And so when you're trying to do research and find statistical significance, when you have such a highly variable system, it's really, really hard for the data to show those differences. So I think that's a big barrier in really understanding, what significantly helps and what doesn't. And but if you survey, more than half of women who are athletes say that they perceive that their performance is impacted by their menstrual cycles. So I think that's why it continues to get attention, even though it's not really bearing out in the research studies.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. And I think one of the points that I wanted to talk about too is the idea of training versus performance. Like when women have to perform, they can perform. They can perform no matter how they're feeling. You don't know what, like a lot of the things are like perceived exertion, or you're talking about fatty acid oxidation at a certain time or all of this. But if you're just in a, if you are in a lab or in a field or on a start line and you need to perform, I think that the elements there supersede a lot of what that underlying physiology, whether you're talking about some marginal movement one way or the other. Does that make sense?
Oh, for sure, because when you're in the game, when you're at the starting line and you're ready to go. I mean, even when you're in the CrossFit gym and it's a totally for fun workout, there's that rush that you get, when that clock is going down to zero. But if you're in a competitive event, that is going to trigger your fight or flight response. And that's a whole other slew of hormones that from the adrenal glands that come into play, your epinephrine, your norepinephrine, cortisol. Testosterone, all of those things come into play more during the performance phase than, say, if you're, routinely training and, say, planning your lifts for the day or planning your run for the day. It's a different scenario, and nature has programmed that to supersede everything because, again, that's our survival pathway.
Makes total sense. And also, would you agree that it might behoove, based on what you said about individual variation, would it behoove a woman to include her cycle in her training logs and just see if she can see any trends to work with?
Totally. I think the more a woman knows her own menstrual cycle, the better off she'll be for many reasons. One is because she'll see patterns, but the most important reason for one to track menstrual cycles is that if there is a big change, something is happening. Maybe energy availability is low. Maybe there's some overtraining or underfueling going on. Maybe there's a hormonal issue. Maybe there's a thyroid issue. Maybe there's illness. Maybe there's something else going on. The menstrual cycle not only, has those performance variations that we just talked about with, fuel utilization, but it's also a vital sign. It tells us when our body is out of balance because nature has programmed the menstrual cycle to be regular and cyclic when things are good, when it's okay, it's good to get pregnant now, things are favorable, things are balanced. But when things get thrown out of balance, the menstrual cycle changes. And it's really important for athletes at any level to know when something's changing because then they can take a step back and say, okay, what's going on? That's what makes it challenging with men, because men don't have such a barometer. So it makes that a little bit more challenging trying to figure out if they're overtraining, underfueling. Now, granted, they're not as sensitive as we are to energy availability because they're not programmed that way, but they still do experience lower energy availability and the consequences of it. It's just a little bit tougher to pick up because they don't have a menstrual cycle. But that's the other big importance of the menstrual cycle is to know changes. And so, yes, every woman should know her menstrual cycle as well as she can.
Yeah, and talk a bit more about cycle syncing. There are people who are obviously proponents of it, and there are people who like hate on it. And I've always been of the school of thought that for some women, just having that layer of structure might be beneficial because a lot of people don't follow any structure training. So if you actually have periods of time where you're actually working on technique or rest, recovery or mobility and all that stuff, and you're actually having times when you're focusing really on those high notes. I mean, if you're following your cycle, great. But I don't see harm in that. I just think that, like, understanding that this, that you are an individual that is unique, and to know your cycles and to not be a slave to it per se.
For sure, for sure. I think there's no harm. There's absolutely no harm. I look at cycle syncing as just another tool in the toolbox that athletes have that they can potentially use that could help to give them that edge in performance, you know. And you know, all the more reason why knowing your own cycle can get you to know your own patterns. So say, for instance, you've got a woman in that first phase, you know, those first 5 days of her menstrual cycle, who, you know, maybe she's a power lifter. Maybe this is when she really wants to do the maxes and, you know, really push the envelope. Well, she may be one of these women who feels like absolute crap during the first few days of her menstrual cycle, or maybe she has really super heavy periods and feels lightheaded during that time. So for her, it might not work so well. You know, maybe she delays her heavy training until her flow slows down, but she wouldn't know that unless she, you know, was tracking her cycles and getting to know them. So it's very good for women to know their own cycles for that reason. But at the same time, and I've seen this with my patients that I have seen for fertility, it is easy to get obsessed by it to the point where it's counterproductive. To the point where it's like, oh my God, my event is falling during my period. I know that it's that I can't do anything during the last week of my cycle. And it can get into your head, you know, just like any other number that we fixate on. We fixate on the scale, we fixate on the barbell, we fixate on the clock. The menstrual cycle is just one more thing to fixate on. And we have to avoid that because it can actually have a detrimental effect. So, you know, when I see patients trying to get pregnant, should I monitor my ovulation? You know, and it's like, well, if it's driving you crazy, no, you should not do that. If it's counterproductive, no, you should not do that. So I think anybody who is cycle syncing and is getting to know their cycle and training to it, you have to really be cognizant of is this turning into an obsession and is this getting into your own head?
Yeah, that's good advice. And also, I think on the positive side, there are ways, like I personally sort of followed it the way that you talk about, because it wasn't until I started tracking things that I recognized that I was having trouble with thermoregulation during that luteal phase. Like I was just like finding myself not being able to manage my internal temperature as well and overheating. So I took steps to really stay on top of my hydration even well ahead of the event, you know, and that helped. And I'm curious if you have ideas of what people can do if they really do experience some of these things in the luteal phase. Like, you know, you hear about carbohydrate cravings, which in lieu of what you've said, make a whole lot of sense. You know, I mean, so how can women work with that if they have even PMS, you know, like actual premenstrual syndrome? Like, how can they work with themselves and their physiology at that time to mitigate maybe when they have to perform?
So I think the first step is keeping like a symptom diary and making sure that, okay, I think I'm experiencing this at this time of the month, but to keep a diary for a couple of weeks and really see if this is a real trend, I think is the first step. Because you don't want to just chalk something up to the menstrual cycle when maybe there's something else going on. So you want to kind of clearly define, okay, is there an association there? And then depending on what it is, you know, like with thermoregulation or maybe even with recovery, you know, if you have trouble with thermoregulation, maybe the cold plunge isn't a good idea. Maybe the sauna feels better during that phase. If someone is experiencing more joint pain during one phase of the cycle, maybe you focus on tissue care, mobility work, and things like that. Maybe you just make sure you bring that front and center. So I think finding the associations is step one. And then step two, depending on what the association is, you consult with your coaches, your trainers, take a step back and say, okay, I'm feeling a lot of pain during this time. How do I make this better?
If I came to you with some of the classic symptoms of PMS sort of consistently, are there ways that we can help women deal with those? You know, bloating, all of the things, the fatigue.
Yeah. I mean, with bloating, A lot of times we can look to diet, you know, if it might be a time when, you know, maybe you don't have the Papagino's pizza, you know, with the 5 grams of salt per pizza, you know, if you're experiencing bloating. So sometimes there are some dietary strategies. Sometimes, like with mood, mood's a tough one. Meditation can help with mood. If one experiences anxiety, depression, things like that ahead of their cycle, definitely meditation and some of the mindset work that people do can be helpful. When people have really severe problems with PMS or premenstrual dysmorphic disorder, which are really serious mood symptoms, we do typically use birth control pills, and that is very effective at mitigating some of those symptoms. You know, it's kind of like it's a very careful balance because, you know, if we read a lot of the literature on cycle syncing and performance, birth control pills are not the best thing for it. However, if you are experiencing great emotional distress to the point that you can't train, that's not doing much for your performance either. So if that is something you need relief with and you know, birth control pills or some other hormonal intervention will help, maybe your performance will actually improve. So, you know, I think it's important when we hear birth control pills are bad for performance that we don't paint it with such a broad brush because, you know, super heavy periods that make you lightheaded are bad for performance too. You know, going into a major depressive episode is bad for performance too. So we have to use our tools and weigh and balance the pros and the cons of each to get us over the finish line to our best performance.
And we will be talking about hormonal contraceptives in a next upcoming episode, just for people wondering about that. Before I leave the menstrual cycle and PMS, I'm curious, you know, there are some studies that show that women can actually be burning more in calories, their energy expenditure can increase, you know, during sort of the luteal phase. And certainly there's these sugar cravings that some women get, chocolate, potato chips, you know, for anything starchy. Should they just listen to their bodies and like give themselves the fuel they need?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that doesn't mean go out and eat the entire bag of chips. You know, I mean, if you're craving the chips, is it the carbs or is it the salt? If
Yeah.
it's the salt, maybe it's like, okay, I got to pay more attention to hydration during this time. Maybe my thermoregulation is off during the luteal phase, and maybe if I train in the heat, I am especially vulnerable to this, and maybe hydration is something to pay attention to. So, you know, for carbs, if your body is craving it, you know, outside of, you know, emotional distress, because I think the other thing you want to realize is if your boyfriend just broke up with you, or if your girlfriend just broke up with you, and you're running to the fridge. That's not a carbohydrate craving that you are needing because you're not getting enough carbs. It's an emotional response. And many people do have that relationship with food, food for comfort. That's a very big thing that people battle all the time. So, you know, understanding those cravings, I think, is step one. Step two is absolutely listening to them and giving your body what it needs.
Excellent. Do we know why some women are more or less sensitive to their hormonal fluctuations?
Oh, I don't know the reason why, but boy, I can tell you it is true. I've seen this throughout my career in dealing with reproductive age women, with teenage girls getting their periods, and with menopausal women as well, and with pregnant women. Some people are exquisitely sensitive to their hormone fluctuations, and other women just have no idea. I don't know the biological basis for it, but it absolutely is real. And in every phase, I've seen this in, like I said, going through puberty. I see this on, you know, a monthly basis with people with menstrual cycles. I see it with fertility drugs. When you give people fertility drugs who have a lot of PMS, you better hang on tight because it's going to be a ride. And the same thing with pregnancy. Some women really experience a lot of emotional distress with pregnancy, postpartum depression, and then again during menopause. And even in the menopausal population, there are correlations with depression and menopause with prior history of depression earlier in their lives. So it is absolutely the real deal.
But we're no closer to really understanding
I don't think we know
why.
why. I don't
I
think we know why. Yeah, it's you know, just another one of those mysteries of the hormonal system.
Yeah.
As we head into summer, rest and recovery are critical for improving sports performance, reducing stress, and living a long and healthy life. we should all invest in better sleep. So think about the thing you lay your head on for 8 hours a night. If it's not exactly right for you, it can lead to needless tossing and turning, or worse, have you waking up with an unrelenting kink in your neck. My new Lagoon pillow has helped me improve my sleep immensely by pairing me with the performance pillow that has everything I need. So I personally was matched with the Otter pillow. Shout out to Team Otter, which I love because it has a gentle cooling effect. And I was able to choose how much stuffing I wanted in it, which is super important to me because I'm doing a decent amount of CrossFit these days and my shoulders are kind of creaky. So having a pillow that is stuffed just to the right height keeps my neck and head in exactly the right position and comfortable for the entire night. And as of fall 2023, Lagoon launched their 100% mulberry silk pillowcases. It's cool to the touch, buttery soft, and great for your skin and hair. You've got to go check out this pillowcase if you want to feel great and look great every morning. Waking up for morning workouts has never felt better. I'm refreshed and pain-free thanks to my Lagoon pillow. To check it out for yourself, go to lagoonsleep.com/performance and take the 2-minute sleep quiz to find your perfect pillow match. And then use the code PERFORMANCE for 15% off your first purchase. That's code PERFORMANCE at lagoonsleep.com/performance, whole 15% off, and the link is in the show notes. You can just click through there.
We have another show, obviously I do it, on the menopause transition, but I would like to briefly address what the hormones are doing there and how women might experience this rapid period of fluctuation and chaos, if you will, from a performance standpoint.
So, you know, there's a lot of layers to that. So I think the first layer in that stage of life, sleep becomes a huge issue. And if you're not sleeping well for a prolonged period of time, that is going to zap your performance. So I think when that starts to waver, that's the first thing you have to pay attention to as best that you can. So I think the sleep disturbance is a huge contributor to the fatigue that people experience and the subsequent decline in performance because they're just not motivated to go out for that 5K warm-up when they slept 2 hours the night before. And the other place that sleep plays the role is the recovery. And in that phase of life, recovery becomes more important because the hormonal changes result in a more difficult time recovering from your training. So when you get hit with the sleep, it's a double whammy to your motivation, energy level, and ability to recover workout to workout. I think that's probably the single biggest thing in midlife that is a result of changing hormones and the effects of, you know, hot flashes that can keep people up, et cetera.
Yeah, and also the mood swings that we talked about become, I mean, I hear a lot in my community about anxiety and more anxiety than depression, honestly, come into play.
Agree completely. And I think it's very prevalent in the athlete population, especially endurance athletes who are performing outdoors. The anxiety is real. I actually just today had a CrossFitter who is in this stage, tell me about that anxiety that she was experiencing with doing heavy Olympic lifts. So, you know, athletes who are putting themselves out at the margins of their performance, they're going to experience that anxiety. Anxiety is going to be front and center because, you know, that they're pushing limits all the time. But, you know, when you're in your reproductive age, pushing limits is exciting. Pushing limits, that's just what you do. And then when the anxiety kicks in, it's like, oh, I'm pushing limits. Now I'm afraid. And yeah, that's huge, huge, huge issue.
And what is underpinning that as far as the hormones that are orchestrating our menstrual cycle? Is it all, you know, you hear these terms like estrogen dominance and balancing your hormones. And what is actually, what are we looking at that is causing much of what you're talking about?
It's the fluctuation. You know, the human body doesn't like change. The human body spends most of its time trying to achieve equilibrium. And so what's happening in midlife is that equilibrium isn't, it's out the window. You know, when the menstrual cycles start changing, that hormonal conversation becomes chaotic. And that hormonal erratic chaos can last for 6 to 8 years. And that really takes a toll, because what's happening is that you've got all of these systems of the body, the brain system, and this is where mood comes in, the serotonin system, which is so wrapped up in our moods. It's expecting to see certain hormonal signals from a regular menstrual cycle. And when it's seeing chaos, it doesn't really quite know what to do. And then it manifests as depression, as anxiety, as irritability, et cetera. And other bodily systems are the same way. Our joints, it's like our joints are used to seeing estrogen. What happens when they don't? They start to creak, they start to hurt. And so that plays out through many other bodily symptoms, which is why that stage of life is fraught with so many, a wide spectrum of different symptoms. But it has to do with two things. One, the changing patterns of hormonal secretion, and two, the changing receptor concentrations in these tissues. So receptors, little proteins that are like the antennae that receive the hormonal signal. So it's not just about the hormones that are circulating in the blood, it's about the antennae that are receiving the signal and translating that to the tissue. That's changing as well. So you got all these changes going on, and equilibrium is the last thing that's happening during that phase of life. And that's why people experience what they do.
And we'll talk about hormone therapy in another show as well, but maybe briefly here discuss that whether or not exogenous hormones can smooth the ride.
Typically, birth control pills are the easiest, most efficient way to help quell that chaos. And what that does is, when you have a consistent source of estrogen and progesterone exposure, that consistent source kind of quiets the white noise, so to speak. It kind of evens things out a little bit. And because it's the mere change of hormones that causes a lot of these symptoms, to even out those changes and to make things a little more consistent can really help those symptoms. And so this is why we use birth control pills during that phase, when symptoms are disruptive and interfering with training and in daily existence. You know, I'm not one, I tend to be very conservative. I like to try to optimize other things first before jumping to hormones, because I think one of the biggest mistakes that has been made by physicians through every stage of life is that, okay, the menstrual cycles are irregular, throw hormones at it. Well, the problem is maybe her energy availability is low. Maybe she's not fueling properly. Maybe she's overtraining. Those are the things you have to solve first. And so once you've optimized those things and make sure that she's fueling properly, that she's not overtraining, you know, if this really is just due to hormonal fluctuations, then okay, maybe we try hormones when everything else is, you know, still not helping. But I think that's the biggest caution. And a lot of mainstream physicians don't even know what low energy availability is. And so that's why they fail to diagnose it. But I think it's important to optimize the foundational things before jumping to hormones. But hormones like OCP or oral contraceptive pills are there as a tool to help in managing the experience. But it's not just one thing. It's a whole foundation of other things that can, you know, that will help relieve the symptoms as well.
How does energy availability impact our hormones?
I'm sorry, repeat that. How does
How
energy?
does energy availability, like, what is actually happening? I mean, women have all heard from the beginning of time, you don't feel enough, you lose your cycle. That used to not be viewed as such a bad thing. It used to be viewed as normal. I hope we all know better now. But like, what's happening? What's the mechanism that by which energy availability is like impacting our hormones in a negative way?
So the mechanism is just so cool. And
Okay.
I say that because
All
I'm an endocrinologist.
right, let's go.
So yeah, I mean, I could do a whole afternoon on this. So there are these places in the body, like in the stomach, in the intestine, in the brain, various places that sense energy availability, like in the fat tissue, in the stomach. It's sensing how much of the energy availability is there, stored as fat. And in the gut, it's how much energy availability is coming into the gut, what types of energy, et cetera. And so these little places in the peripheral parts of the body feed signals to the brain that tell the brain there is enough fuel or there isn't enough fuel. If there isn't enough fuel, now the brain says, okay, I got to go out and find food. And so that's when we get hungry. That's when we go out and eat. It manages hunger, these various things that manage body fat percentage and whatever. These little sensors in the peripheral body send signals to the brain so that the brain now can tell the body to eat and do whatever. So, when, despite those signals, when the body is still not getting enough fuel, it's now turning into a five-alarm fire because fuel is so important, particularly for women, again, because what we are biologically wired to do is conceive and carry a pregnancy. And that is highly dependent on energy availability. So what happens is that there's a communication now. The brain is like, okay, trying to eat more here, but somehow food is still not available. Now we bring in the adrenal glands, and now the fight or flight, the cortisol system is activated. And so now it becomes more urgent to try to find food. And if food isn't coming in even still, now we start breaking down muscle. We start breaking down other parts of functioning to fuel normal physiological needs throughout the day. And so that's when you start to see people get tired, their performance suffers, they lose muscle mass, they retain body fat because the stress response system is involved now. It's like the angry parent is now involved in just locking everything down and making it difficult for everybody. So that's kind of how it works. And it's a mechanism that's rooted in survival. And it's very powerful. And that's one of the areas where I think we need to work with our hormones and with our physiology rather than against it. And what I mean by against it is when we start to, have people on keto for long periods of time because we think, okay, carbs are bad. It's a whole carbs are bad thing that is going against how we're naturally wired. And I think it's finally coming full circle because I think we're realizing that, low carbohydrate intake is a huge culprit in poor performance.
And at what point does the you've mentioned the HPA axis and like the cortisol, what is happening then with our estrogen and our ovarian hormones that shut down our menstrual cycle?
So there's a direct connection between those systems in the periphery, the gut and the fat tissue. It connects directly to the reproductive system to shut it down.
Gotcha.
Because what it's saying is that this is not time to carry a baby. There's a famine in the world, and this is not a favorable time to get pregnant. And so this also happens around the time of puberty. So if you have teenage women who are, say, gymnasts or they're competitive athletes, and they are under fueling and overtraining, and they're out of balance, they're not going to go through puberty because the body is saying, no, we cannot have periods now because we cannot get pregnant because there's not enough food around. So this is why women are particularly sensitive to energy availability. It's because we are wired for these processes, particularly to carry pregnancy.
And a lot of doctors will tell women to stop exercising, but they really need to eat more.
Exactly. It's all about the fueling and less about the exercise. Now, it's a balance.
Right.
Obviously, you have to take a look at the training because if there's too much volume in the training, then now you're looking at injury, regardless of whether you're fueling well enough. So, but in general, yeah, doctors say, oh, you gotta stop exercising and eat more, when really you just gotta fuel your training and do it smartly.
Right.
Endurance sports should be accessible to everyone, right? That's why we are so excited to be partnering with Motiv. Motiv is one of the fastest growing training apps in the world today, with thousands of amateur athletes signing up every month and a nearly perfect 4.9 star rating in the App Store. You are not a template, and your training plan should not be either. Prepare for running races, triathlons, cycling events, duathlons, or swim runs, however your season schedule shapes up, and get training written by some of the best coaches in the world in each discipline who know what it takes to help amateur athletes reach their goal on race day. The app takes the training written by those experts and then creates the most optimal training plan for your schedule, abilities, and goals. Plus, the training is fully customized to your race schedule. How much you can train each week, your current abilities, and the goals you want to achieve in your race. You can use the app for free as long as you want, or get all the upgraded features from the app for just $19.99 a month. But as a Feisty listener, you can sign up at mymotive.com and use the code Feisty for 2 months of full premium access. That's right, you get 2 months of premium for free. So you quite literally have nothing to lose. So head over to mymotive.com, mymotive.com, and use the code Feisty, F-E-I-S-T-Y. And on a personal note, I know the founder of Motive, and he is driven to make triathlon and all endurance sports more accessible for the athletes who care about their performance, but who aren't quite ready for a full-time personal coach. If that sounds like you, definitely try the app for 2 months for free. You literally have nothing to lose. For decades, running shoes have been researched, tested, and designed for men. Brands have relied on the shrink it and pink it approach to sell male shoes to female customers. That's why we are so excited to be working with Hedas. Hedas designs athletic footwear for women that elevates performance, safety, and style. Hedas unlocks the science behind women's biomechanics through dedicated research, creates better shoes for women that support their longevity and performance, and establishes new design standards to promote transparency in a male-biased industry. Hedas have a lower ankle collar to reduce rubbing, a breathable mesh toe box to allow for ventilation and to allow for female toe shape, a special kind of plate in the midsole to keep tired legs going, a narrow heel cup to reduce heel slippage and take the pressure off our Achilles, and a rounded instep to create a snug fit. Hedas has 3 shoe models designed for different sessions: the Alma Cruise for long runs, the Alma Tempo for training days, and the Alma Speed for pushing the pace. I've personally been running in the Alma Cruise and I love them. It's the shoe I always wanted and never knew I needed. The fit is perfect in every way. You can get your own pair of Hedas at hedas.com and use the code Feisty20 for 20% off. That's Feisty20 at hedas.com and it will all be in the show notes.
Let's talk for a minute about estrogen as an anabolic hormone, because I don't think many people think that way. When people think anabolic hormones, they think testosterone. But for us, our estrogen is very important for our muscles, correct?
Oh, for sure. And the bones too. The bones and the muscle go hand in hand. So, you know, we know that what happens when estrogen is lost, and that's bone density declines tremendously. And that's just not in menopause. This happens during reproductive age and is one of the most common causes of osteoporosis, is that when women lose their menstrual cycles and that estrogen stops cycling during reproductive life, bone does not achieve the peak density that it needs to achieve to sustain into the later decades of life. So in this way, estrogen is incredibly anabolic for bone. It's needed for bone turnover and bone deposition. And to your point about muscles, it's the same thing. We know that when estrogen stops cycling later in life, one of the first things we lose is muscle mass in addition to bone mass. And that has to do with receptor changes and things like that. In our reproductive years, when you're not fueling enough, the muscles are breaking down because the body is looking for fuel, and it's looking to, you know, to break down anything it can find to supply fuel. That is kind of an indirect effect of estrogen on muscles, because, you know, it's a couple of rungs down the ladder. So it's more of an indirect impact of hormone cycling and the reason for the loss of the hormones. But the most direct evidence of estrogen anabolic effect is definitely on the bones.
I feel like we know and correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like we know more about estrogen than we do progesterone when it comes to all the performance, or is that not true? Everyone talks about estrogen all the time.
Well, I think it's because, we know when it's lost, things happen, and I think it's, pretty well stated in the literature. Progesterone, really, its role is at the later end of the cycle to get the uterus ready for implantation. That's what progesterone's role really is. And when you think about what's happening during that phase and how energy is being utilized, and even sometimes how we feel during that phase, it's to dial down intensity in that cortisol response. And this goes back to cycle syncing, is that you don't necessarily, you probably won't get the most efficient benefit of doing your high intensity short bursts, say CrossFit workouts during your luteal phase, just because the body's trying to do something else at that time. It's trying to get ready for implantation. Because again, even though we live in a civilized society and we choose to get pregnant or choose not to, the body's wired to do this, and it tries to do this every month. So this is the body's trying to accomplish one thing, and we're kind of working against it, trying to do something else. And so that's one of the principles around cycle syncing. But yeah, that's really what progesterone is there to do. It's to kind of dial things down and get the uterus ready for pregnancy.
And it seems to have a pretty strong impact on mood.
It does. It does in that when we are giving, say, birth control pills for contraception or cycle regulation or whatever else, we find that the side effects associated with oral contraceptive pills are typically related to the type of progestin rather than the estradiol. Now, most birth control pills have the same estrogen. It's ethinyl estradiol. That's pretty universal across 90% of the contraceptive pills out there. But what varies is the progestin. You've got levonorgestrel, you've got norethindrone, you've got lots of different things. And so when people have mood symptoms when they're put on contraceptive pills for the first time, we change it up and try a different progestin. So yes, these progesterone derivatives do have a significant impact on mood. And when you think about PMS, in the latter part of the cycle, that's when progesterone is dominant. So that's when people get moodier. So yeah, it totally has an impact on mood, more so in some people than the other. This is where you see different sensitivities of different people.
Makes total sense. So let's wrap this up as we come to the end of the show with testing, because everybody is hormone testing now, not just in the menopause phase or perimenopause phase, but even Inside Tracker now will give you, I'll get my estrogen levels. I'll get my, should we, and at first I was like, okay, but I don't know what to do with this information. I mean, I think we've been testing so much other stuff for so long. Like cholesterol, we at this point kind of understand. We understand iron. We understand like a lot of the things that have traditionally been tested. But then you see these new levels coming and you're like, okay, but like, what are there levels we should know? Should people know their levels of estrogen like they know cholesterol or other lipids? Where are we going with this? What do you think?
Well, I think whenever you get a test, you have to have in your mind, well, what question am I trying to answer? What am I looking for? Because with reproductive hormones, especially estrogen, progesterone, FSH, LH, the pituitary hormones, they're changing constantly. And so you can draw your blood. An Inside Tracker has lots of other stuff that it gets besides estrogen and progesterone. But for the reproductive hormones specifically, first of all, they are secreted in a pulsatile manner throughout the day. So you could draw your blood at 9 a.m. and at 3 p.m. and have completely different estrogen and progesterone levels depending on the time of day. So that in that way, blood just random blood testing isn't really helpful. Now, as a fertility specialist, I check day three FSH, estradiol. I check estrogen, progesterone on specifically day three of the menstrual cycle early in the morning, because then I know exactly what I'm looking for and I know exactly how to interpret it. But when you get these things randomly, it's very hard to interpret reproductive hormones. Now, there are other hormones that aren't quite so volatile, like thyroid and insulin and things like that. And I think Inside Tracker is very helpful for that. Even testosterone, I don't think quite is quite as volatile as the rest of the reproductive hormones. Although testosterone is going to go up around ovulation, that's just naturally what it does in response to LH. So yeah, I think Inside Tracker is probably good for some things, but for reproductive hormones, they're a constant moving target, and I'm not quite sure how we would interpret, something like that, unless it came in like off the charts. If your
Right.
FSH comes back at 100, that might tell you that okay, you're prematurely menopausal. So something dramatic like that could be helpful, but in the sense of just knowing what they are, it's tough with reproductive hormones, but could be helpful for other things.
Where does, and this could be a whole show of its own, but I want to make sure that we mention it in this milieu of hormones, because thyroid seems to be something that's kind of tricky with women. Like, what should women know about their thyroid hormone as we bring this to the top?
So it's super important. The thyroid is really important. I think, we tend Mainstream medicine doesn't tend to really pay that much attention to it until after age 35, but I think we need to be paying more attention to it early in life too, just to be sure that people, aren't, there isn't something that we're missing along the way, especially when we know that persistent among athletes, among female athletes, low energy availability is such a widespread problem. Because if you've got an athlete that is persistently in LEA and advancing into Red S, what happens is that the thyroid shuts down as well. In the body's effort to conserve energy and conserve fuel, one of the things it does is that it slows its thyroid production, all with the intent to lower energy expenditure. So a lot of times you find thyroid disruption in people who have persistent low energy availability. We see this in people with anorexia, people who aren't athletes, but they have severe clinical eating disorders. We see the same sort of thing. Very, very slow thyroid. You'll see very low heart rates in these people as well. Could be in the 40s, 50s, awake and alert. It is incredibly important and very responsive again to energy availability. I think we need to pay more attention to it, especially in our athlete population, that's younger.
So just a good idea to include that in your testing panel.
For sure. Yep. And you don't have to be fasting. It doesn't have to be taken at a given part of the menstrual cycle, like your reproductive hormones kind of need to be. Just getting that if you're going to do Inside Tracker or, I don't think Dutch tells us anything about thyroid. It really focuses on steroid hormones, but Inside Tracker is pretty good because it does cover all that other stuff. You always want to check a thyroid.
If you were to give us just a few handful of tips for good hormonal health, to support your hormonal health, what would they
Eat well.
be?
Seriously, it's about the fueling. And I'm Italian. So I'm partial to food. That was Eating has never been a problem in my neck of the woods. But yeah, I mean, there is so much toxic diet culture out there that it is such a big problem. And so I think the first thing people need to do is be sure that they're getting enough good stuff to eat. Now, it doesn't mean that you don't eat French fries, that you don't have a drink. It's everything is in moderation. 80-20, I think, is always a good way to go. So for hormone health, energy is front and center. It's number one. Be aware of your menstrual cycle. Know your body, know your body, know what you respond to. If you're experiencing symptoms, don't afraid to put together a symptom diary to try to figure out what associates with what. But knowing your own cycle and knowing your own body is incredibly valuable for any athlete. Those are probably my two big ones.
And does sleep affect hormonal health?
Oh, for sure. Sleep affects everything. Optimize sleep. That's the other easier said than done. I think wearable technology is awesome for sleep tracking. And I think sleep tracking can be very valuable. I know for me, I learned a lot about my own sleep patterns, that have made a huge difference. And all I had to do was go to bed earlier. That's it. I can really increase I can decrease my sleep debt. I can increase my restorative sleep simply by going to bed 30 minutes earlier. And I only knew that because I was tracking my sleep. So yeah, I would say sleep tracking is another valuable tool. And the last thing, I'm sorry, while I'm on a roll here before I forget, is to not to, to put numbers in perspective, no matter what these numbers are, whether they're the numbers of, whether you're tracking your cycle, whether you're wearing a Whoop strap or an Oura ring, or whether you're doing lab tests, you want to keep it in perspective and don't obsess. Don't let it get in your head, because that's the worst thing that can happen, especially if you're an athlete. It's not you, you need to clear your head rather than garble it up with more obsessions with numbers. And as competitive athletes are, they're type A, and that can feed right into that. So that would be my other piece of advice, is keep your numbers in perspective and don't obsess.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I was going to say that one of the things that I learned is that I just need a little more downtime between day and sleep. You know, like if I go to bed with a book, literally just a half hour, everything is better than if I just like try to hit the pillow, you know, and shut down really quickly. It just doesn't work. It's just better to just give myself that wind down time because stress is such a prevalent part of life. Like it's a good
Yeah,
time
and
to,
put the phone down, make that, put
Or I
that
have a book.
phone. Yeah, exactly. Take a book, put the phone away, as it goes off every time an Instagram follower, does whatever. Yeah, I think dialing down the tech, it's hard for all of us, especially, if you set your alarm on your phone, it's very tempting to, okay, I'm just going to check my Facebook one more time or my Instagram one more time, and then, and then the cycle starts, and 2 hours later, you're still on your phone.
Yeah. Good advice for all of us. Well, thank you for sharing your knowledge with us. I look forward to coming back and talking about hormonal contraceptives and exogenous hormones and all of that. Boy, that's a topic that's woo, talk about things that are going into, I don't even know what to say. We'll talk about it next time. It's a big conversation.
Absolutely. I look forward to it.